This is the podcast for Gabriel Garcia Marquez's Death Constant Beyond Love, that short story, right? Again, I'm pitching this in kind of the existential vein, a question about choices, because I want to focus specifically on the senator and his choices that he makes, right? So we have this before we talk about that, let's look a little bit about Marquez, right? What he claims he wants to do and why this looks a little bit strange to us in terms of, you know, why those dollar bills fly like butterflies. Why does everything stick to the walls? This is a style of writing known as magical realism. Right? And Marquez, while he doesn't invent it, he's certainly the greatest popularizer of it, because what he wants to do is take the old folk stories and folk tales that he was told as a kid, and kind of where, you know, think about stories that we know, like Hansel and Gretel and Little Red Riding Hood and stuff like that, right? Those just seem so bizarre and strange and kind of magical, and yet nobody bats an eye at how absurd they are, right? So he wants to be able to do that. Magical realism, the kind of the best definition I can give for it off the top of my head is that it's treating the fantastic as if it were mundane, so that you can treat the mundane in a fantastic way as well. Right? You kind of explore the wonder of everyday events. Gabo, as he's called, is, you know, another Nobel Prize winner. He's a journalist for a while until he becomes really successful with his novels. And his big novel is known as 100 Years of Solitude, right? This huge novel that comes out in the late 60s. He starts to work on it in 1965, and it becomes an international bestseller twice, once in Spanish, and then the next year, right, it comes out in 67 in Spanish, and then in 68 comes out again in an English translation, and again becomes a million seller. So he keeps writing and writing. He's politically involved a bit. What he's really interested in is government accountability, and this makes him kind of the enemy of lots of governments. But he doesn't really need that. He becomes such an international figure, and then when he wins the Nobel in 82, he's this international, you know, star basically through it. We see that he just died 3 or 4 years ago. Died in 2014. He died of pneumonia. And he's, you know, he's got great, a very old man with enormous wings is a short story that always gets anthologized by him. And this Death Constant Beyond Love is another one, right? And in it, he's giving us this little village here that is kind of shocking in what it's presenting to us, right? And just how bad this place is, kind of how unconcerned these people are. And I think that if we look at it, we see that it's really a lot more complicated than we originally give him credit for. It's, you know, you see that the title, you have that gloss there about the title, that it is kind of a flip on Love Constant Beyond Death, which is, I gotta admit, not a great translation, because it wants to refer back to the Song of Songs, right? For love is stronger than death, stronger even than the pits of Sheol. The flash of it is the flash of fire, a flame of Yahweh himself, right? From the Song of Songs, right? This idea that love is stronger than death. What Marquez wants to say is, nope, it's not, because you can only love something that's living, right? Because love means to place somebody's good above your own. Are you literally going to say you're going to place the good of a corpse above your own good? That's not love. That's morbidity, right? And that becomes really problematic, right? So he's playing with that idea, right? And we have the senator out there on the stump. He's going for re-election, and he's gonna give the campesinos, the peasants in the town square, this vision of their future and how it could be. But even the vision he gives them is kind of old and tawdry and tired. It's not a great looking thing, right? He's used it before. They've all seen it before. They're all bored by it, right? But what the hell? It's, you know, it's a half day off work, so we get to go see this guy. And that's another problem here too, is that most of them don't have work. We see that the town is really kind of, it's this desert and almost deserted place, this poverty-stricken hovel place. And the only real kind of interesting work there, well, I don't want to say interesting work, it's probably backbreaking work, is a mine that mines saltpeter. And I want to talk a little bit about saltpeter there, because lots of these symbols here all coalesce into kind of this bigger meaning for this text. Saltpeter is an interesting mineral, all right? It's basically used for two things. Number one, it's one of the three necessary components for gunpowder, right? So it serves as kind of an agent of destruction. But number two, right, in kind of an off-label use, at least at the time that Gabo's writing this text, right, it was thought to be used in single-sex environments in order to tamp down the male libido. What it means is that they would surreptitiously feed, army recruits in basic training or seminarians or anything, right? Places where they wanted to kind of make sure that to be crass about it, make sure that the men didn't get too horny. It turns out that it's actually ineffective for that, right? Recent medical studies have shown that, but that didn't stop it from being used. And so for Gabo, what this becomes then, what for Marquez, what this becomes then is a symbol not only of destruction, but of infertility. If you look at the land, it's a desert. Nothing's really growing there, right? The saltpeter itself is a symbol of infertility, right? You can't be fertile if you're not going to want to have sex, and it's just not going to work. And here, right, is our great senator, who's, you know, kind of a rising star. He's got a wife and kids in the capital, but here he is out stumping the hinterlands. He's going to take a break, and he's in Rosa del Virrey, and, you know, the only rose in the whole place is the rose that he brings into the place, which is kind of, you know, ironic and disappointing at the same time. And he's going to walk around like kind of like a medieval king bestowing favors on people. Why? Because it's so much easier than actually making systemic change. He gives that old lady a donkey because she needs a donkey. Right? He makes sure that it has his campaign slogan painted on the side. But what does that do for the rest of the villagers? Oh yeah, we're still living in poverty, but hey, the next time the senator comes, I might be lucky enough to have him give me something. Right? What does that cost him? A hell of a lot less than what it would cost him to, I don't know, vote for a social safety net or figure out a way to bring manufacturing back to this town or fishing back to this town or even, like, let the smugglers back in, right? We see even the smugglers don't go there. But we see really kind of the senator's true political stripes when he gives his second speech to kind of the important people of the town, the people with the money. And he tells them, listen, all that stuff I said this afternoon, that means absolutely nothing. Because you and I both know that the minute this town becomes prosperous, you and I are both sunk. We're not necessary. So things are going to stay the way they are, and you're going to contribute to my campaign, and I'm going to make sure things stay the way they are. All right, this kind of underhanded political an affirmation of all our suspicions about the real political wheelings and dealings that go on behind the scenes. And into this story then enters this father-daughter duo, the Farinas, Nelson and his daughter, Laura. And Marquez is getting us even with the name here, Farina. Farina is a type of wheat, right, that you make bread out of. Kind of the staff of life, right? This so it represents this, you know, it's something you take from fertile land. It's this grain you take from fertile land and you make sustenance from it. Nelson Farina is not a nice guy, is he? He's a murderer, convicted. He's escaped from prison, from Devil's Island. And he, all he wants is a new ID so he can stop looking over his shoulder so that he's no longer, you know, like has to kind of be on the run. And what's he willing to do to get that new ID? He is literally willing to pimp out his daughter in order to do that. He is willing to essentially sell his daughter's virginity, his 17-year-old daughter, to the senator in order to get his own kind of freedom there. Right? It's really kind of horrifying. And he has a little insurance. He puts a chastity belt on her and tells her, go make this offer to the senator. He can have you, or he can have sex with you, if I can get, you know, I'll send the key for the chastity belt if he agrees to give me new documents, essentially give me a new identity. Is this the way parents treat their children? Right? And here's kind of the big thing that ties in with the name, right? What I think what Marquez wants us to think about when we think of this parent and child relationship is another parent and child relationship that's based on grain and wheat. It's a story from Greek mythology. It's the story of Demeter and Persephone. Demeter, the goddess of, essentially the goddess who is responsible for making stuff that is planted in the ground grow, right? And she loves more than anything else in the universe, she loves her daughter, Persephone. Well, her daughter Persephone, who's also a goddess, gets kidnapped by Hades, the god of the underworld, and taken down to the underworld. And Demeter, you know, nobody sees Hades do this. Demeter's very upset, looking for her daughter, can't find her, enlists the aid of the gods. None of the gods can find her until eventually they figure out that she must be down in Hades. And Demeter pulls the ultimate trump card when it comes to the fertility of the land, when it comes to basically keeping these things alive. Remember how when we talked about how with Leda and the swan, how none of the gods wanted to get involved in the Trojan War because the gods were going to lose. No matter who won, the gods were going to lose half their worshipers and therefore half of their sustenance. Well, Demeter pulls that card. She says, nothing will grow on the face of the earth as long as my daughter is kept in Hades. Which means that, yes, all of humanity will die, but guess what? All you gods will die too. Hades says, I don't care. You're all going to end up with me. I'll be in charge of you all. But Zeus can't have that, and his brother Neptune can't have that either. Poseidon, they can't have that. Right? So they go down to negotiate with Hades for the release of Persephone. Right? Now, there's one law in the underworld that transcends even the gods. It's the idea that if you eat the food of the dead, the food of the shades, basically, the food of those ghosts, you can never return from the underworld. And so while this argument is going on, Persephone, who just happens to be standing by the side, listening to these people negotiate for her life, pulls a pomegranate from a tree. And depending upon the variation of the story you read, she either eats 3 or 4 or 6 pomegranate seeds. Hades notices her doing this and says, aha, she is bound to me now, right? She cannot live. She has eaten the food of the dead. No matter how well we bargain, you all are coming down here, right? Go ahead, Demeter, do your worst. You're all coming down here. But what they end up working out this deal for is Persephone has to spend as many months in the underworld as seeds she has eaten. So depending upon the verb, let's say it's 4. She's eaten 4 seeds, so she has to spend 4 months a year in the underworld. And, you know, Demeter's not very happy about this. She says, for those 4 months, nothing will grow on the face of the earth. But in the 8 months when my daughter is with me, then the earth can be fruitful. Then humans can plant and reap and harvest and have their sustenance, and they can serve and worship the pantheon, these gods. And that's the deal they work out. Now, contrast that, right? Nelson Farina, the man who is willing to sell his daughter for his own selfish ends, versus Demeter, who is willing to throw over the entire world for the love of her daughter. You don't get farther, right? And it's all about the wheat. It's all about the fertility of the land. It's all about the harvest there for both of them, right? So Laura Farina ends up with this guy, and the senator says, oh, she's beautiful, right? I might want to do this, right? And we see that, oh, yeah, he's going away. The senator continued to scrutinize her thoughtfully, and while he wasn't tying the laces, he wondered which one of them would end up with the bad luck of that encounter. He says, you're just a child. She said, don't believe it. I'll be 19. Oh, so I'm sorry. She's actually 18. What day? The 11th. He says, we're both Aries. It's the sign of solitude. And think about that, right? Think about the existential idea that we are fundamentally alone, right? The senator says he's not used to sudden love affairs. He knew that the one at hand had its origins in indignity, right? He holds Laura Farina tightly between his knees and says, no one loves us. And Laura Farina, then he reaches down to undress her and realizes she has this chastity belt on. And she says, oh, no. I'll go and get this, right? My papa has it. He told me to tell you to send one of your people to get it and to send along with him a written promise that you'll straighten out his situation, right? Then he closes his eyes and he said, remember that whether it's you or someone else, it won't be long before you'll be dead. And it won't be long before your name won't even be left. And you see that that's a gloss from Marcus Aurelius's Meditation, the Stoic philosopher, right? I don't know that you want to trace existentialism back, you know, roughly 1400 or 1500 years, but, you know, here's the idea, right? And here's the choice. What is he going to do? And this is kind of an amazing choice that he makes. He tells her, yes, I will do this, right? Tell your son of a bitch of a father that I'll straighten out his situation. And Laura says, if you want, I can go get the key myself. Senator says, forget about the key. Just sleep with me. Just be with me. And that's it. It's good to be with someone when you're so alone. And this final little paragraph, right? He lays his head on his shoulder with his eyes fixed on the rose. The senator held her about the waist, sank his face into Wood's animal armpit, that smell she has, and gave in to terror, right? Remember that anxiety and that dread, right? He knows he's dying. 6 months and 11 days later, he'd die in that same position, debased and repudiated because of the public scandal with her, and weeping with rage at dying without her. Does he ever have sex with her? Doesn't look like he does, actually. He's debased. He's repudiated. He's given up his wife, his family, his career. He knows he's dying. Right? What does he get out of this? He gets to feel the closest he's ever going to feel to not being alone. And here's the scary part, the kind of fundamental thing. Yes, what good is sex going to do him? Listen, sex is great. Sex is the closest you're ever going to get to being another human being. But what happens after? You both roll over and fall asleep alone. You are never going to be another person. And this, the existentialists have this exactly right. You never get to be somebody else. You can never be fully explained, fully understood, or fully understand someone else because you're not them. We are fundamentally, unalterably alone. And that's why this senator is weeping with rage and dying without her. Yes, he appears to be very terrified about the end of his existence. Right? I'd like to hope that maybe you're not so terrified about the end of your existence if you think about it at all. Right? But this fundamental awareness that he will die alone, and it's not about sex, and it's not about that, but he's willing to give up everything so that he feels a little less alone, right? He's willing to give it, right? He doesn't care what people say about him, right? That is truly the existent, that radical freedom that the existentialists give us, that idea that we can chuck it all in, right? Radically change our life on a dime. Every millisecond we sit here, we're making a choice. Every millisecond you spend listening to this podcast, you're making a choice to do so. You may do it kicking and screaming. You may do it unwillingly, but you do it nonetheless. Why? Because there's some end that you want. And, you know, every choice is basically done that way, right? Not just because it's random, but because you see some good in it for you. And this is kind of the fundamental existential choice here, right? That fact that he recognizes death is stalking him. He recognizes kind of the absurdity of all this. He calls back to Marcus Aurelius there, and he's willing to give up his public good name, his wife and his family, just so that he will not feel alone. That's truly, truly an existential theme here.